All right, hit that billboard. 3, 2.
Please silence all electronic devices.
Mr. Speaker!
I have said this since the end of June. I'm surprised that the entire budget was held up over one policy issue.
Lord, strike me down if I vote for this bill.
You are making a mockery of this process. You are deceiving all of North Carolina. Your leadership is an embarrassment to the history of this great state.
Any further discussion or debate?
From the Carolina Inn in Chapel Hill, this is the WUNC Politics Podcast. I'm Jeff Tiberi, and I'm glad to be taping an episode of the podcast here in front of 300 of our listeners. Welcome, everybody, here. Welcome if you are listening on demand wherever you found the podcast, iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, Spotify. We are rolling our two podcasts together in this taping. Typically, you get that long-form one-on-one conversation on a Tuesday, and then on Friday, it's Becky and Rob reviewing some of what happened in North Carolina politics. So this edition will be Becky and Rob in a bit, but first, we're going to chat with Patrick Woody. He is the executive director of the North Carolina Rural Center. He has been on the podcast before. It's been almost, I believe, 2 years since Patrick was on the podcast, and we're going to chat about some of the issues that folks in rural North Carolina are facing, among them broadband, a healthcare coverage gap, and also the census. Patrick, welcome back to the podcast. How are you?
Thanks, Jeff. I'm doing well. It's a great crowd tonight.
Great crowd.
Should be in Chapel Hill.
Should be in Chapel Hill. You made a good joke before about not too many things going on in Chapel Hill because of the struggling basketball
team.
Well,
actually,
should we leave that in the final cut?
My board chair asked me this afternoon what I was doing this evening. I told him I was going to the hill, and he said rose, snow, or pink.
For those of you who live in the Triangle, you might not be familiar with those hills.
I know where they are.
A big, broad question to start. What's the state of rural North Carolina from your perspective?
Well, I think the state of rural North Carolina is really improving. We've seen some real progress on some issues of importance to rural citizens. But the thing we should know, and the thing I would want everybody in our state to know, is that how you're doing economically in rural North Carolina is largely a function of where you live and where, within the geography of rural North Carolina. We're the second most populous state. Only Texas has more rural people than the state of North Carolina. We're tremendously diverse from the mountains to the coast. At the Rural Center, we serve 80 rural counties. All 80 of those counties have population densities of less than 250 people per square mile. But of those 80 counties, 26 of them are in metropolitan statistical areas. So they're really, those 26 rural counties have economies that are much more integrated into the metropolitan regions that they are adjacent to. And by and large, those 26 rural counties, as you might suspect, are the healthiest economically by a lot of measures. The more remote rural counties that are not along our urban-suburban corridors in this state or near one of our regional cities around the state are doing less well economically. But we have seen some real progress. The recovery from the Great Recession was not really measurable or noticeable for most rural counties until about 2015. The recession ended in late 2009. The recovery's been slow, and I think most people are generally aware of how concentrated that recovery has been. And it's really, I think, a concern for the entire state, and it's also a concern to the two counties where that recovery was most concentrated. Wake and Mecklenburg have done it extremely well.
So Wake and Mac each have roughly 1 million residents at this point. This is a state of 10 million people, so you're talking about 20% of the state's population right there.
And about 4.2 million people live in those 80 rural counties, so about 42% of our population.
Now, you and I spoke on Monday. For me, you have your head wrapped around all of these things, but for me to try to get my head wrapped around some of these things, of the state's 100 counties, 33, and they're all rural, have lost population since 2010.
And that number is a number that's been coming down. After a recession, population loss is generally a lagging indicator. So the longer you go after a recession, you see that recovery of the population. And we project that by the time the next census rolls around, we will have about 33 counties in the state that have lost population.
And that next census is rolling around. This is 2020, year that ends in a zero. Census is conducted. April 1st is National Census Day. And having an accurate count of the population is important for a number of reasons. I want to hear from you on some of those. I'll just note the political ones. You want to make sure that people are appropriately represented, whether that's in Congress or in the state legislature. And we do know that because of the growing population and in Wake and in MEC and in other suburban and urban counties, political power, the distribution of it starts to transform a little bit. It starts to shift. I mean, this has happened in this country for 240 years, but it is shifting in North Carolina. 2020 is going to look different than 2010, as you just noted.
Absolutely.
So as you all are trying to achieve the most accurate count possible, how are you going about doing that?
Well, we've taken on a major campaign of our own to all rural counties to send the message of how important a full and accurate count of every person in rural North Carolina is. And we want every person in the entire state to be counted, of course. We know, and the NC Counts Coalition tells us that there are 18 counties in North Carolina that are projected to be the most difficult to count because of a lot of factors, the makeup of the population, the demographics, absence of broadband. You need to go online to fill out your census, and there's a lot of folks in rural North Carolina that can't do that. So we at the Rural Center have actually adopted two of those 18 counties, and most of those 18 counties, not all, but most of them are rural counties that are hardest to count. And we're going on the ground in those two counties, Halifax and Northampton, to really work with local organizations, nonprofits, the faith community, everybody, local government, heavily involved, public libraries, incredible way that we reach people in rural communities, to really get all of them involved in making sure that everybody in their community gets counted.
Anything else on the census before we move on?
The one thing I would say about the census is the balance of political power in this state has been shifting for decades. Mm-hmm. And we really are, though, at a point where it becomes really noticeable in a big way. Up until 2010, a majority of people in this state, from the beginning of recorded human history in North Carolina until 2010, we were without question a majority rural state. Since 2010, that's not so anymore. That population's gone from about 50-50 to 58-42, and we're going to continue to see that kind of a trend line.
Right.
From a political power standpoint, without getting into the politics or who represents what districts, just to give you a sense, we've done a lot of work recently in the Northeast Prosperity Zone. There are 19 counties. It's almost 25% of the land mass of the state of North Carolina is in the Northeast Prosperity Zone. Those 19 counties have 17 members of the General Assembly that represent them. And by comparison, Mecklenburg County has 17 members of their delegation to the General Assembly. Wake County has 16. The one thing I know before that census even happens is that that number in the Northeast is going to go down. Mm. There'll be fewer members representing those 19 northeastern counties, and there probably will be more members representing Wake and Mecklenburg counties.
You mentioned broadband a moment ago. I want to shift topics to focus on broadband for a little bit, and specifically fast, reliable internet. To help us get into this, we're going to pull up a cut from a report that Rusty Jacobs did. This is from a while back. Rusty Jacobs visited some eastern North Carolina communities, and the aim of his reporting was to look at efforts to expand high-speed internet and the access through an agency called the Rural Internet Access Authority, a program called the ENC Initiative. It was part of that. Let's give a listen.
Spring Hope in Nash County, Williamston in Martin County, places with quiet, sometimes deserted downtown areas, empty storefronts echoing faintly of a time when these places thrived.
We're tobacco-raising people. We're peanut-raising people. The farmers are crying. They're not hiring unskilled labor anymore because they're not able to farm.
That's Willa Dickens, Director of Business and Industry Services at Halifax Community College. She's also the county's designated e-champion, responsible for spearheading the ENC initiative in her area. Halifax County's biggest tobacco farmer went out of business this year, and the next largest farmer scaled way back. And that's just part of the county's sad story, Dickens says.
We're hurting. And we don't have it. West Point Stevens has been our biggest industry. You remember the movie Norma Rae? That was about West Point Stevens.
It'll pass off. It's just temporary.
Oh, well, that makes it okay. She's only deaf for 1 hour. She's only deaf for 2 hours. She's only deaf all day.
She can get herself another job.
What other job in this town? This is the only job.
That was Sally Field there at the end. That's a cut from a report that Rusty Jacobs did on the effort to improve broadband and internet in Eastern North Carolina. When do you think he filed that report?
That was 20 years ago.
It's 2003. Let's think about some of those communities or communities like them, Spring Hope, Williamston. Where are we today compared to then?
Well, where we are today, in the last couple of years, we've made some tremendous progress. The problem is it's not happening fast enough. But the progress has been made for really three big reasons. The first thing that happened was a couple of years ago, we started a state-based grants program for rural broadband, operated by the State Broadband Office within the Department of Information Technology. It's called the GREAT Program. In the first year, $10 million was allocated, was awarded to 14 projects that touched 19 Tier 1 counties. A Tier 1 county is the most economically distressed counties in the state of North Carolina, so 19 of those. Second major thing that happened was in the long session of the General Assembly this past summer, a bill passed that really clarified the law around what EMCs, electric membership cooperatives, could do, making it clear that EMCs could form partnerships to deliver broadband to their customers. So we have EMCs that serve parts of 75 of our 100 counties in the state. The third thing that happened is we began to see some federal dollars that we had not seen for a long time. Since about 2011 and 2012, we saw a pretty good chunk of federal dollars come to North Carolina from the economic stimulus bill after the Great Recession. We hadn't seen it. We'd had pretty much of a drought for a long time. And we've now seen in the last 2 months three projects totaling about $25 million announced in eastern North Carolina. Last mile fiber to the home, at serving some communities that are in desperate need of being served. So those three things have really made a significant difference in the landscape.
We're chatting with Patrick Woody here on the WONC Politics Podcast. We're taping this event at the Carolina Inn in Chapel Hill. It's part of our Pints and Politics event, the first ever Pints and Politics for WUNC. You can follow Patrick, by the way, on Twitter at Patrick Woody, W-O-O-D-I-E. I want to chat with you about the healthcare coverage gap and about the very testy and divisive issue of Medicaid expansion in this state. 35 states have expanded Medicaid. North Carolina is not one of them. This is the central reason why we don't have a new state budget and why Republican legislative leaders and the Democratic governor continue to butt heads. The legislature will come back in April. Do you have any optimism or reason to think that we're going to see movement on Medicaid expansion in North Carolina this year?
I don't have a great deal of optimism because it is an election year. There also was a recent federal ruling that affected Arkansas that had to do with work requirements, which has also led to one of the major sponsors of a bill that we supported in the General Assembly called the Working Families Act that is actually a state-based approach to Medicaid. It's not Medicaid expansion, but it is a state alternative to Medicaid expansion. And that sponsor has withdrawn, and so the path forward is looking pretty muddy right now. I will say we've gone across this state twice in the last 3 years. From our first conversations with 80 counties and the leadership in the 80 counties we serve, and there are 312 municipalities across those 80 counties, one of the top issues we heard over and over again, and I heard it from CEOs of rural hospitals, is the fear of losing the local hospital. And we've certainly lost our share. We have 600,000 uninsured North Carolinians in this state right now. We know that that number is disproportionately rural citizens. We also know that the Working Families Act that I mentioned that did carry a work requirement, which we're not crazy about, but we were certainly willing to accept, because we believe this is an issue where we need to find compromise. We need to find some middle ground where, for the sake of people, we can really move the ball forward. That Working Families Act would have covered 400,000 of those 600,000 uninsured. As I talk to rural CEOs, hospital CEOs, they are delivering an unsustainable volume of charitable care in their hospitals. And many of our citizens, because they have no viable alternatives, are seeking their care in the most expensive way possible by going to the emergency room. So we're going to try to approach this argument from a really fact-based place and really advocate for all the reasons why we have got to close that coverage gap.
You mentioned the divisiveness and the hyper-partisan nature, particularly when it comes to healthcare. Who's the most unifying figure in this state? Is there an elected official who you look at and you say, all right, I've got a little optimism there. This person might be able to...
Well, I'll tell you a little anecdote, and it's not directly answering your question, but it's the place we need to get back to. The North Carolina Rural Center wouldn't exist if it hadn't been for Lieutenant Governor Bob Jordan from Montgomery County, a rural man from the rural town of Mount Gilead.
And who recently passed away, right?
Yep. Passed away last week, and I had the opportunity to attend his funeral. And the most touching moment of that entire funeral was when the family, and there, you know, Governor Cooper spoke, and Erskine Bowles did a great eulogy. We had two former governors that were there. And the most touching moment of the whole thing was when the family looked at and acknowledged and said to Jim and Dottie Martin, thank you for being here. This means a lot to us. Jim Martin was the man that defeated Lieutenant Governor Bob Jordan for the governor's race. And yet they had a lifelong friendship after that governor's race, stayed in touch with each other, and to see that happen in that setting in such a meaningful way, that's the place we need to get back to as a state. This is a state of great leadership that has come at different times from both sides of the aisle. And we've always been able to work together to tackle the really big issues in this state. And what worries me the most and what keeps me awake at night is I don't see that capacity to solve the really big long-term problems in this state, and that worries me.
Make sure you drop a Q mark in the recording there, because that right there needs to make the final podcast cut. He's a graduate of Piney Creek Elementary School, Wake Forest University, and Wake Forest Law School. Please help me in thanking Patrick Woody for coming on the WNC Politics Podcast. You can keep up with Patrick on Twitter, at Patrick Woody. You can also find out more about those efforts on Census Day by following the NC Rural Center, at NC Rural Center. You are listening to the WNC Politics Podcast. We will be back in just a moment.
Even the old folks never knew why they called it like they do. I was wondering since the age of two, down on Copper Line. Copperhead, copper beat, copper kettle sitting side by each. Copper coil, copper Georgia peach, down on Copper Line.
Welcome back to the WUNC Politics Podcast. I'm Jeff Tiberi. As we do at this time each week, a discussion about some of what happened in the endlessly wild world of state politics. Here for our discussion are Becky Gray from the Conservative John Locke Foundation and Rob Schofield from the Progressive NC Policy Watch. Hey there.
Hey guys.
Such a treat to be here. Thank you.
Live audience and everything. Let us begin with the federal bribery trial of Greg Lindbergh. He's the insurance magnate and mega political donor currently on trial for allegedly trying to bribe the state insurance commissioner. This week, jurors heard secret recordings. Insurance Commissioner Mike Causey cooperated with the FBI and wore a recording device creating those secret recordings. Federal prosecutors have made their case. Defense attorneys for Lindbergh and his associates, John Palermo and John Gray, are floating the theory of entrapment and that Causey was out to get the wealthy donor. To what extent are you buying that argument, Becky?
I'm not buying that argument at all. You know, when you look at the evidence, and of course, I mean, this is a trial, and so we'll see how all this plays out. But what we do know is that Mike Causey was approached by Lindbergh early on, very soon after he was elected, and with a proposition that he replace some of his employees or a employee that oversaw Greg Lindbergh's insurance companies and was promised money for it. Mike Causey immediately recognized that this was a problem and went to the FBI, went to the officials. I think, you know, in this very hyper-partisan and in this very divided environment that we often find ourselves in, I just think it's great to see somebody, and Mike Causey happens to be a Republican, I'd be saying this no matter what party he belonged to, but to have an elected official who recognizes what's right and what's wrong and actually acts on it. Well,
I think Mr. Lindbergh's got some real problems. And I too, commend Commissioner Causey for doing the right thing, although to a certain extent, it's sort of like you might as well praise somebody for not robbing a bank. I mean, that's his job. I mean, he's a public official. Someone tries to bribe you, it's probably, you know, you should expect that they would go to the FBI or they'd go to law enforcement. There's some very damning evidence that's been put forth. I think Mr. Lindbergh has got big trouble. And, of course, the big political issue that looms over all of this is the fact that Mr. Lindbergh has spread around so much money. He's given money to Democrats. He's an equal opportunity would-be briber, I guess, but he's also given $2.4 million to the lieutenant governor who's running for governor, likely to be the nominee. Even the woman who's running against him, the state lawmaker who's running in the Republican primaries, questioned why he took $2.4 million. I think we're going to hear a lot more about that in the months ahead.
We are just a few days away from Super Tuesday. Early voting will conclude on Saturday. Seems like no one is missing an opportunity to stump here in the old North State. South Carolina primary will precede the North Carolina Super Tuesday primary by 3 days. North Carolina, the third most delegate-rich state going on Super Tuesday. What has struck either of you in this final sprint, if anything? Rob?
It seems maybe that Biden has bottomed out and has started to rebound. It's hard to say. I mean, we had a great session earlier this week at a Nancy Policy Watch event. Tom Jensen, the amazing pollster at Public Policy Polling, told us his latest polling. It's basically a three-way tie amongst the old white guys. It's Bernie and Bloomberg and Biden. They're all, what are they, all 79?
They're 22, 22, and 20 in the poll,
right,
and they're 79,
like
79.
The three B's.
Right, the three B's.
So
what Tom had seen was forever was that Bernie was basically flat at around 20%. There was 40% at one point for Biden that went down to he was sharing it with Bloomberg, and now Bloomberg has dropped a little bit after his debate performance, and maybe Biden's creeping back up. And it looks like his numbers are coming up in South Carolina as well. He got the James Clyburn endorsement yesterday, a very emotional endorsement. It seems like maybe Joe Biden has bottomed out and is on the comeback trail.
Well, I think it's surprising, too, that Bloomberg has come in so strong in such a short amount of time. Now, I don't know whether that's because he offers an alternative ideologically for Democrats or whether that's the power of money. You know, we'll say, but that's one takeaway that I've had is that, you know, we've quickly become, it's a race between the three B's, Bernie, Bloomberg, and Biden.
The Democratic primary contest is getting a lot of the attention, a lot of the air in the room. Let's set it aside for a moment. There are a lot of interesting races on the ballot next week. On the Republican side, you have a lieutenant governor's race with 9 candidates. You have an 11th district congressional seat with 12 candidates. Both of those are likely heading to runoffs. You have a really interesting Republican, for my money, attorney general's primary. Mm-hmm. On the left, you've got newly drawn congressional districts in the second district. It's now a Wake County district, and also the 6th congressional district, which is much of Guilford County, part of Winston-Salem. We will know come Wednesday morning who the next congressperson is going to be from the 2nd and the 6th district. Give me, after the Democratic circus, what is the most interesting race to you on this ballot?
You know, I think that the Attorney General's primary is a very interesting race. You know, Josh Stein barely won that attorney general's race against Buck Newton.
That's correct.
In 2016. Now he's gotten a lot of national recognition, since then, as he served as attorney general. But I think that the Republican candidates for that are really interesting. Christine Muma, who was part of the Actual Innocence Commission, Jim O'Neill, who is also a very well-known attorney in
district attorney for South County.
Yeah, thank you.
And that's a contentious one for sure.
Already is a contentious. And then Sam Watt. So you've got two criminal law experts with a civil law expert on that Republican side. As you mentioned, the lieutenant governor's race, really interesting. And when you've got that many candidates, to get out of a primary, you've got to get 30% of the vote, 30% plus one. That's what they're all going to be struggling for. So in those two, we may likely see a runoff later.
What is the second most interesting race to you?
Well, to me, actually, first of all, it's May 12th. That's when the runoff will be. So we'll all be back going back to the polls.
If there is a federal runoff.
Right.
If there are no
state
runoffs,
you're right,
it's April 24th.
You're right, it's April.
Good luck keeping track of all this stuff.
Lieutenant governor, it's kind of interesting, but, who cares who's lieutenant governor, really?
All right, what do you got?
It's kind of interesting. I mean, that's basically a platform to run for governor later or something else.
We've been in this room an hour and a half, and we haven't mentioned a U.S. Senate race.
Well, that's what I was going to say. The thing that's most interesting, I think Cal Cunningham's going to win. I think he's pretty far ahead. But it's interesting to see, all this money coming in from, what is this Faith and Power PAC that's been dumping money into Erica Smith's campaign in an effort to sort of lift her up, I guess, presumably to try and make Cunningham have to spend more money. I don't think they really think they can knock him down. But gosh, I'm very concerned that that's a harbinger of, that's what this election's going to be about. It's going to be about dark money. It's going to be about fake news sites like we're seeing on Facebook. We've had these crazy pro-Trump, phony news sites showing up all of a sudden. We've got 8 months to go, guys. It's going to be a real Donnybrook, and I think we're going to see a lot of dark money with ulterior motives probably flowing into our state, in addition to just the dark money that's going to, support the candidates.
Rob Schofield is director of NC Policy Watch. Becky Gray, senior vice president at the John Locke Foundation. Let's give them a Carolina Inn thank you for the conversation. Remember that, as always, you can subscribe to the WUNC Politics Podcast at iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, Spotify, wherever it is that you get that on-demand listening. Stay up to date with whatever is happening in North Carolina politics and tune in to special coverage on Tuesday night when North Carolina is one of 14 states to go in that Super Tuesday primary. Will Michaels on the mic that evening. For Becky and Rob and Patrick Woody, I'm Jeff Tiberi. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you again soon.
Down on Apple Live. It doesn't come as a surprise to me. It doesn't touch my memory. Man, I'm lifting up and rising free. Down on Apple Live. Half a mile down to Morgan Creek. I'm only living for the end of the week. Hercules.